This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. It will be up and ready to go very shortly. So please stand by.
Okay, before we lose any more time trying to stay connected to the station, this is Off the Hook. We are on the air. I hope we're on the air. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes.
Who's torn pretty much all his hair out now. Red Hack. And Alex.
Good evening.
Rob P. Firefly.
Good evening.
And Gila.
Hello.
Bob, sorry for all the mayhem and wait a minute. Red Hack. Is that Red Hack? He hasn't been on the air in 10 years. Red Hack, is that you or is that an imitation?
It's a doppelganger. No, it's me.
Oh, wow. Have we been skipping over you all these years? No, this is a special occasion, right? Where are you?
Well, I got lost in the studio and ended up in the closet.
I think we're all lost in the studio. That's what happens.
I'm in California. I moved to California.
That's why we don't see you around. Okay. We've missed you. And welcome to the station, as it is. We're kind of virtual right now, and as you can see, kind of discombobulated. Anything you want to share with the listeners as to what you've been up to for the last decade?
I don't know, getting older, I guess. living in California. It's enjoying the heat waves and the forest fires, and
Well, that's a positive attitude, to be enjoying all the mayhem and chaos. We just had a blast here, so we're having a lot of fun trying to connect to the station and all that. It's wonderful. But you were recently listening to all editions of the show, and it kind of made you reminiscent, I guess.
Yeah, it made me nostalgic. I mean, I started doing the show, it must be like 20 years ago, right? And then, and so I went back and I was listening to the old episodes, and it was kind of cool. It's like this time capsule, of the person I was then.
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly. It is a time capsule, because what you do is you go back and you hear not only what we're talking about, but you hear how the technology has changed. You hear how phones sounded different, and we were talking about different types of connectivity, period. When we first started, there really wasn't an internet as we know it now. It's a time capsule. It's really something, and it's great to be able to record this and save it, with all its imperfections. It's a picture of where we've been, and hopefully we'll continue to do that. And that's true of many shows here on WBAI. So, anything exciting technology-wise going on in your part of the world?
Oh, always. No, I don't know. I mean, anything specifically you were curious about?
Well, no, I mean, you work in high tech. We're not going to say where you work or sure. anything like that, but obviously that would draw you. any advances or interesting adventures that you care to share?
No.
Okay, good. Well, then in that case, how about just insight as we discuss various things on this show? I got to say, you're hopping all over the place. We're looking at you on video. Yeah. And I would think you would have the best connectivity of anybody, but you're kind of jumping every 5 seconds to another part of the room. It's kind of weird looking.
Let me see. It might be that somebody else in the house is playing video games or something.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't do that. That might start a war. Okay, well, Alex, Rob, Padilla, any updates from you guys and on things that have happened in the last week?
What's been going on? We had a 2600 meeting in person.
Yes, well, how was that? You went to in Manhattan. You guys actually had it. Did you have it in the building or did you have to go outside?
We did not have it in the building. Construction was still underway at the atrium on at 375 Third Avenue. So we had it at the main entrance to the building, which if I remember correctly, was something you suggested. And there's a big awning there. There's a lot of space to stand and move around, and we were protected from the weather. So it was there was maybe a dozen of us there at one point, and it was really, really good to see everyone again. Fed my soul as these things do. And we also had the Zoom, the virtual meeting, up on my phone at the meeting, so we could sort of connect the people who wanted to show up in person and the people who wanted to attend virtually. And it kind of worked. We're figuring things out, and hopefully we'll have more figured out by next month.
Yeah, if you expect perfection, you've come to the wrong place, because we're always figuring things out and tweaking them. But we had 13 meetings on Friday throughout the country. And I was very impressed with that. I figured we'd have much less than that, but the enthusiasm that we got from people was great. And as we've mentioned, we're only having meetings in places where the vaccination rate is 40% or above, the total vaccination rate, which pretty much rules out other countries at the moment, but hopefully not for long. And it rules out a number of states as well. So there are more meetings that want to start, but obviously we can't yet. But the 13 that we started with, I'm pretty happy with that, and hopefully we'll see more people and get through this. And we've lost Red Hack entirely now.
Wow, no, I'm still here. I should be here.
Well, you're not here. Still here. I don't see your face anymore. But maybe the video game player has gotten the advantage. Alex, looks like you've got something you want to say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but it was a bit of a short week because we had celebrated the 244th birthday of America.
Was that this? Oh, I missed it. What?
Yeah.
Always. Oh, okay. Next
Happy
time.
Happy birthday, definitely. America! Whenever you have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was wonderful because out here in Pennsylvania, in the Poconos, we had a whole bunch of people over, and it was great. You know, all. But I will have to say this. It's a bit of a riddle. We had everyone here very safely. However, more than half the people who came to my house were unvaccinated.
And why is that exactly?
Can you figure it out?
Pick me.
Go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry, I got so excited. Alex, were they children?
That's correct. That's right.
Uh-huh. So. Well, that's better than my guess. I was going to say, are they dumbasses? But okay, fine.
You know, I would say, you know,
they have a lot to 60% learn.
60% of the unvaccinated people were also illiterate. So,
wow.
You know, there's that.
Shut up your standards,
well,
man.
Not a high bar out there in Pennsylvania.
I had, you know, my two of my closest friends came over, and they brought their three kids, and we have two kids. So we were outnumbered by unvaccinated peoples here. Thankfully, you know, the virus doesn't affect children as readily as adults. But I am really hoping that, you know, we can get on the ball about vaccinating children soon.
Yeah. I know it's being looked at.
I don't know how it is for you in New York, but in California, it almost feels like things are back to normal. Like we went on a vacation last week. We went out by Yosemite. And I mean, basically, you know, masks, people don't wear masks anywhere anymore, mm-hmm. for the most part. I mean, people do, of course, and that's fine, right? Especially children, things like that. But it just, I don't know, it just felt very much like things had kind of gotten back to the norm.
Well, there's not a whole lot of indoor things going on at Yosemite, I don't think, right? It's mostly outdoors.
Well, no, but I mean, I just mean in, you know, restaurants and mm-hmm. shops, grocery yeah. stores, and, you know, all of that, right? You know, there was this period of time where it was this kind of, what, Black Mirror-ish situation, and it felt very much the opposite of that last week.
And for good reason. I mean, your vaccine rates are up there. You're in an acceptable zone. There are places, though, where that's not the case, and that's why there's more restrictions in some parts of the world. So it's not done yet, but Yeah. We're making progress, and obviously we're seeing how to make progress and what we need to do, what we need to continue to do. So, yeah, these are good steps. And in New York, it does, I would say, what do you guys, Hila, Rob, you think it's back to normal? Does it feel back to normal to you?
It's getting there, but, you know, people are wearing masks less outside, and currently the new accessory you're seeing is the wrist mask. Because people accept that they're still wearing them inside, they're still wearing them on transit, mm-hmm. but when you're outside, you take it off, you wrap it around your wrist.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like a little clutch. It's adorable. Yeah. We went to a movie over the weekend. We went to a movie in a theater over the weekend, which was a brand new, not a brand new experience for us, obviously, but first time in a long time. It was great. There were not a lot of people there. And it was a theater where we got to select our seating ahead of time. There were two rows. Yeah. There were people two rows ahead of us, people a row behind us. I had forgotten what it felt to be like laughing in public with people
mm-hmm.
at the same time, not like lagging over Zoom.
Because you're known for that. You laugh a lot in public, and the sound of your laughter carries for blocks, and it's a wonderful thing. These little things, they matter. They really do. Just being able to go to a meeting, go to a movie, walk outside without a mask. You mentioned mass transit. Yeah, you still have to wear a mask on mass transit in New York. That's correct, right?
It is, and I can tell you I was on the subway yesterday. They kept, I'm assuming, hitting the button for the announcement that said you have to keep a mask that covers your mouth and nose uh-huh. on over the entire train ride. And people heard it and were, like, personally offended and felt victimized but still put the mask on. You heard them. You watched them. They didn't have a mask on. They heard the announcement. They made a face and put the thing on. So it's fascinating. It's working.
Mm-hmm.
It was the most crowded train I've been on in a long time, actually.
Yeah, well, that's why, because we still have to be careful. You know, I worry a little bit about London because they're pretty much wiping out all their restrictions, including wearing masks on mass transit. And they're not yet at the numbers that we are at. So it's kind of wishful thinking, and I really hope it works out well. But we have to pay attention. We have to do the smart thing, and hopefully we'll continue to do that.
Acknowledge there's going to be a bit of awkwardness and a sort of a period of adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we've never been through this before, so it's new for all of us, and not everybody knows everything, or nobody really knows everything. People are going to make mistakes. Okay, so let's get into some news. You might have heard today that the former president has filed proposed class action lawsuits against Facebook, Twitter, as well as CEOs Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, Sundar Pichai. They come 6 months after Trump was permanently or temporarily suspended from all three platforms. He announced the lawsuits at a press conference today following an early report by Axios. He referred to the cases as a very important game changer for our country. However, the claims are based on an amalgamation of mostly untested or disregarded legal arguments. I mean, it wouldn't be Trump if it wasn't. And they come after numerous other failed attempts to sue social media companies over suspensions or other forms of moderation. I should actually read the headline from this Verge story. Donald Trump files sweeping nonsensical lawsuits against Facebook, Twitter, and Google. That pretty much wraps it up there. The complaints allege that social media companies violated the First Amendment by suspending Trump and other users from their networks, an argument that courts have typically disregarded, ruling overwhelmingly that the First Amendment is intended to limit censorship by the government, not private companies. His effort is backed by the American First Policy Institute. You might never have heard of them. They're an advocacy group founded by former Trump officials, and there are a lot of them, including Linda McMahon and Brooke Rollins. They seek damages on behalf of any users who have had an account wrongly restricted or curtailed on Facebook, Twitter, or a Google service. It asks courts to declare Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act unconstitutional. Trump paradoxically cited Section 230 as a legal jurisdiction for suing the companies in his press conference, however, saying incorrectly that once they got Section 230, they're not private companies. Yeah, okay, so that makes almost no sense whatsoever. Alex, can you tell us how much sense it doesn't make?
Well, sure. I mean, look, this is certainly a crazy lawsuit, but, you know, and everyone likes to poke fun at this. I think that, you know, there may be some other things going on here, like in most of Trump's PR actions. You know, one thing you also forgot to mention, or maybe just omitted from that article, Emmanuel, is that Trump is also seeking something known as affirmative injunction, injunctive relief here. And affirmative relief means that you're compelling somebody to do something. Usually an injunction enjoins you or prevents you from doing some kind of further harm. But here he's seeking the restoration of all of his social media accounts. Now, on the face of it, look, I entirely agree with you and the pundits that, you know, the First Amendment, the first word of it, is Congress. So it applies to the government. And it was designed to apply specifically to the federal government until the process of incorporation made the First Amendment applicable to the state. So it's about Congress and the government and governmental actions, not necessarily state actors. But while everyone's poking fun at this, and this lawsuit likely has no legs, tactically, I think it could accomplish a lot, you know, albeit through an abusive process. I mean, think about this. First of all, the media has flocked to Trump for this announcement. He's back on the front pages. He's the leading story now on all of the mainstream media networks.
My God, we're talking about him. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. It's important for him because he's been significantly muzzled since he inspired an insurrection on January 6th. Mm-hmm. But now fundraising is in full swing for AFP, the America First Policy Institute, the Constitutional Litigation Partnership. Who knows what the hell is going to be done with that money? Secondarily, seeking injunctive relief, and this is why I mentioned it, is really important because that gets him into court very quickly. Injunctive relief means that, you know, the court, when you're seeking that, the court's probably going to put you on some kind of expedited briefing schedule where oral argument is going to be heard rather quickly. So this, again, allows him to garner more media coverage, whip up support, and most importantly, fundraise. And then thirdly here, while everyone's laughing at Trump for making an argument that Facebook is a state actor when it's clearly a private company, well, I do have to say things may not actually be that simple. And in May, I wrote an FT, a Financial Times opinion piece about this. Because this past April, in a case that was entitled Knight Institute versus Trump, the Supreme Court dismissed an earlier ruling by a lower federal court, the Second Circuit, that Trump had violated the First Amendment rights of people that he blocked on Twitter. Now, the Supremes dismissed this particular case as moot because Trump was no longer president. Mm-hmm. Biden was president at the time. But at the time that this decision was handed down from the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas took this weird opportunity to make the point that these digital platforms, social media companies, you know, and Twitter in particular, digital platforms provide avenues for historically unprecedented amounts of speech. Those are Justice Thomas's words. And he suggested that these platforms should be viewed as common carriers, like telephone companies. Remember, we talked about this a few weeks ago.
Right.
And subject, therefore, to similar regulation. And then there's this other case, Packingham v. North Carolina, in which Justice Anthony Kennedy described social media as the, quote, modern public square and as one of the most important places for the exchange of views. And that's a case that the plaintiffs who won the case against Trump and Knight Institute v. Trump relied on to establish that precedent, that the president could not block people from viewing his Twitter account because it was being used for official business. So there is this push and pull. On the one hand, in certain circumstances, social media is a public square when politicians are using it for official business. And on the other hand, it's owned by a private party. So Justice Thomas raised yet another hand to suggest that this strange hydra of state and private interests suggests that social media companies should be regulated like telephone companies as common carriers. And because we believe in something called due process, which affords every party an opportunity to be heard, Trump's going to be able to make these arguments about regulation of social media companies. He's going to be able to gain more support for social media platform regulation, more support for the overturning or the amendment of Section 230, and most importantly, to fundraise through these new political action committees. So I think there's a lot more going on below the surface. It's easy to laugh at the complaint and say, this is idiotic, but I think tactically, it might have been a smart move.
Well, I mean, yeah, it gets people talking about it, but legally, I'm not sure it's going to advance in any way, despite what Clarence Thomas says. I mean, you know, you can say that Twitter is the equivalent of a common carrier, but the fact is, you know, you need a phone connection. You have to have a telephone, you know, and you can choose a company, but once you choose a company, they are providing you with that service. Being able to tweet, that's, you know, at what point do we say this isn't an essential service? This is something that you choose to have for your entertainment. I mean, is HBO going to be considered a common carrier? You know, I have to have, you know, a particular episode of a show every week, or I'll go nuts. It seems nonsensical when you put it in context with those vital services that we are told we have a right to, and cannot be cut off from.
I mean, it sounds like either way, it would require congressional action to actually designate it as a common carrier, right? So I think the point Alex is making is that it might spur Congress into action if Congress was weighted in the direction that would allow that to happen, right? So the lawsuit itself maybe doesn't have any merit as the law stands now, but putting that complaint in the public sphere puts the idea in the head of people that maybe it should be a common carrier.
Let's say
it should be regulated that way.
Let's say that happens, and let's say it becomes a common carrier somehow. It's different because this is global. Okay, so a company in a different country doesn't have to abide by those rules. So how would that even work?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and that's a problem for the social media companies, not necessarily the federal government, though. You know, international compliance is very expensive, very burdensome, very lucrative business for a lot of private parties when it comes to social media platforms. But hell, you know, Congress, you know, it's not Congress's problem to figure out Facebook and Google and Twitter's compliance issues. So I don't think they'll give much thought to that. They'll probably think about it somewhat. But those are exactly the points that I was making, that this may spur Congress into action. It's also something that if this case lingers, and I don't think it does, I think it'll get to oral argument, perhaps on injunctive relief. That would probably fail. I anticipate then there being a motion to dismiss this particular action. That will have probably an extended briefing schedule, and then this case will probably be gone from the docket in maybe 4 or 5 months. That's my guess. If it sticks around longer than that, then this can be a feather in Trump's cap in terms of fundraising for the reclaiming of Congress in the 2022 election.
But he's always going to be able to fundraise. No matter what he does, he'll always be able to do that. So I don't think the fact that he's able to raise money off of nonsense is something that we should judge ourselves harshly about for calling it nonsense. He's always going to have that ability. That is what he is good at. But if I'd like to focus on another law in Florida called SB 7072. It's a controversial and sweeping regulation of social media platforms, currently on hold thanks to Judge Robert Hinkle, issued a preliminary injunction blocking nearly all of it. The legislation now at issue was an effort to rein in social media providers deemed too large and too liberal. Balancing the exchange of ideas among private speakers is not a legitimate governmental interest, Hinkle wrote in his order. Moreover, the law discriminates on its face among otherwise identical speakers, partly thanks to an eyebrow-raising exemption, get this, for companies that operate a theme park. You can't make this up. Yes, the legislation compels providers to host speech that violates their standards and forbids providers from speaking as they otherwise would. SB 7072 was signed by Governor Ron DeSantis. That should have been a warning sign right there. Back in May, it limits when web services can kick off users. It includes a ban on suspending or annotating the posts of political candidates, a requirement that users can opt out of algorithmic sorting systems, and an antitrust violator blacklist for companies that break the rules. And as mentioned, the rules don't apply to a company that owns and operates a theme park or entertainment complex, which apparently was to placate a company like Disney. So this judge, quite rightfully in my eyes, has put this on hold. It seemed really silly to start with. Alex, were you familiar with this?
Alex? Yes, I was familiar with that law and the crazy carve out specifically for Disney in the Florida law. And again, I think this is something that, you know, if they weren't designing it to be unconstitutional, I would have, you know, a lot of questions about the mind and the mental capacity of a lot of the folks behind this particular bill. But again, you know, look, it's Florida. Sometimes, you know, you can't spell Florida without duh. And wow. You know, this thing was rightly struck down.
Oh, wait, but duh is spelled D-U-H.
Well,
I don't know where you went to school.
Yeah, that's true. Well, maybe it should be changed to Florida, actually, literally. Uh-huh. But I think this law seems to have been designed to fail. The judge came to the right conclusion that these are editorial judgments, that these editorial judgments are protected by the First Amendment, and you can't regulate them in this particular way. But again, you know, I think it also illustrates that there's a big push and pull when it comes to the law. You know, and I keep going back to this fact that we have treated Trump's social media account, when it suited us as liberals, as a public square. That's troubling, you know, and that gives now, look, the law goes both ways here, because now conservatives can hang their hat on the fact that we did, in fact, treat Trump's Twitter account as a public square. Well,
hang on a second. What choice did we have? He was using it as a mouthpiece to you know, say all his nonsense. Were we supposed to ignore it?
Well, we could have. I don't think we could have.
I don't see how that's possible.
The issue in the case was about whether or not Trump was blocking people legally or illegally. And the court came to the conclusion that because this social media account, you know, was Real Donald Trump on Twitter, was being used for official business, it then became part of a public square. There was an exchange of ideas, a robust exchange of ideas. And even in the comment section, which, you know, everyone knows is utterly false if you've read some of the comments on Trump's tweets. But if it was being treated as a public square, then we did, in fact, regulate it in a certain way that would require some kind of editorial judgment on behalf of the government to be curtailed. And now they're using that as precedent.
The thing is, I see it as not so much Twitter being the public square, but the Trump account being the public square, because he's the president of the United States speaking to all these people, and to forbid somebody from seeing that is the problem right there, that the president of the United States is barring select people from hearing his words. You know,
That's absolutely correct. And you're right about that. It's not the entire platform. But even if one small portion of that platform is being treated, for all intents and purposes, as some form of government property, you know, that can lead to a lot of other forms of regulation and balancing.
Yeah, I didn't see it as government property. I saw it as, you know, a forum that he happened to be using. You know, it's like he's on NBC. And somehow he's able to block you from watching NBC. You know, it's not NBC's issue; it's his issue. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. But if it's being treated as a public square, it means that the government has some kind of interest in what goes on there, and they exercise that interest in this Knight First Amendment Institute v. Trump case, and Trump lost. And I think it was a great precedent at the time, but now I think it can lead to a lot more ramifications.
Go ahead, Red Hack.
Yeah, I had a question, though, because, you know, we're sort of saying, well, you know, the his account specifically was the public square, right, or was not being restricted. So shouldn't it be in the rights of these private companies to decide who is allowed? I mean, it's a little different, right? It's saying you cannot have this platform, therefore there is no longer a public square. We're removing that. It's like if I owned a park and I forbid the president from coming to speak in my park, right? that's my right as a property owner. So, I mean, if you treat the platforms as, okay, this is their environment, their platform that they can decide who is and who is not on it, then, you know, that decision is basically saying, I mean, I guess one can make the argument then, well, maybe all politicians shouldn't be allowed on there, right? But it's just, to me, it's interesting because it's sort of like, well, okay, I didn't let him, you know, make his speech in my private property.
Well, that's a lot of it, right? I mean, and that's, I think, the overriding principle behind a lot of the mockery of this particular lawsuit of Trump is that, now look, this is a private entity. It's a private company. They can exercise editorial judgment as they see fit. They can ban people when they want to ban them, especially if they violate their terms of service. And Facebook even has this independent judicial oversight board now that came to this independent conclusion, so it distances itself somewhat from the actual decision-making process. But on the other hand, you know, when we do treat even some portion of these social media platforms as public squares, that is indicating that even though it's a private company and a private entity, the ability to do whatever one wants on that particular platform is not absolute. So the users don't have ultimate power over who they block and who they can see, especially if there's some kind of government business going on. I mean, I totally agree with you, Red Hack. I think the world would be a much better and, frankly, safer place if we didn't have any politicians on Twitter. I think these social media platforms are totally unfit for purpose. They shouldn't be used for international diplomacy or repartees with, you know, dictators of aspiring nuclear powers like North Korea. It's totally crazy. The fact that we have something that I looked at in 2007 as a silly distraction now being used for international diplomacy. So I would support that effort.
Yeah, but the thing is, you can't blame Twitter for that. Blame the people using it in a bad way. You know, you should not use it for international diplomacy. I totally agree with that. But that's on the user. And I think rules are different for public figures than they are for individual citizens. So a public figure, you can say, no, you can't block your own constituents from hearing what you have to say in this particular platform, but you know, Joe Schmo can block whoever he wants because he's a private citizen, and that's, I mean, that's part of the agreement.
There are plenty of official government channels, though, for communication.
Absolutely.
Right? Traditionally, yeah. Until whatever, however many, 5-10 years ago, that was it, right? You know, that was how governments communicated with each other, how politicians communicated with each other, instead of exchanging jabs on Twitter.
Yeah,
right?
And they still can. They still can,
but I guess then the question is, maybe should they be allowed to use these non-government platforms to have government speech? I mean, maybe as a candidate, fine, they're a private citizen, they can have a Twitter account, but once they're president or a congressperson, then they should not have that anymore.
But I don't see it as a problem unless they abuse it, you know, and when they abuse it, yeah, then you got to step in and say, no, you can't do that. But you know, for instance, Joe Biden, has he done anything on Twitter that's really bothered us?
But
you know,
is,
most people
all,
don't.
This is all subjective, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone sees it differently. I'm sure there's somebody who's looking at Joe Biden's Twitter account and, you know, cursing under their breath.
Oh, okay.
Right?
I'd like to hear OTH@20sitcounter.com. Let us know what Joe Biden did on Twitter that got under your skin. Rob, go ahead.
Any potential regulation of social media in general is going to come up against the problem of scale. Because the issue is, when it comes down to it, a company owns a website, they should be allowed to decide who is and isn't allowed to write on that website or what they're allowed to write. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a tiny blog that nobody reads and that I don't even write on, but like there's a functionality there for people to sign in and leave little comments if they want. And, you know, I, as the admin of this thing, get to decide whether I want to keep those comments or filter them away or ban people from commenting. And, you know, where's that line? Like, if Twitter has to let everybody use it that wants to say what they want to, then, you know, do I have to keep comments on my own web space that I, you know, host independently? Do I have to let people write what they want on there? And that's ridiculous. And when the party of like small government and don't regulate my private industry, how dare you, comes in and says, hey, private industry, you're not doing it the way we want, so we're gonna ban it all, like that's a bit crazy.
Go ahead, Alex. I want to move on to something else.
Yeah, sure. I don't entirely agree with the notion, though, that users are the ones who should be held responsible for using these particular platforms in a manner which is unfit because I think that the social media entities themselves have really encouraged this kind of back and forth and this kind of participation. I mean, think about how much more participation, how many more eyeballs did Twitter get on its platform during the years 2016 through the early stages of 2021. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a massive amount of growth. It's also great for Facebook. It's great for anywhere there is a clash of these types of ideas. And I'm all for clashes of ideas, but the dialogue is wholly unproductive, especially when it is a dialogue between nations. It all seems really silly. And I hope that we look back on this 10, 15 years from now and say to ourselves, what the hell were we thinking in letting this happen? Things could spiral out of control so quickly. You know, there are nuclear powers discussing international diplomacy efforts with each other. And the comment section to that is almost insufferable when you try to read it. It's a crazy system. It's a crazy situation. And I think, you know, it could be the end of the world if we don't rein this in.
You're reading some very interesting Twitter accounts. You got to share those with me because I want to know just what you're seeing. Red Hack, last word on this.
Yeah, I just want to say one more thing. I think that when it comes down to regulation, and I think ultimately that's what we're talking about here, whether or not Twitter should be regulated. But if it's going to be regulated, then, you know, generally what tends to happen is you have an all or nothing thing. So rather than saying this politician should be allowed to be banned, it should be all or nothing. Either you have no political speech on the platform, and that's the regulation, or you allow it all, and that's too. Because as soon as you start to pick and choose, then people claim unfairness, bias, etc., and it'll never resolve. We see this with religious displays, right, in public places, same thing. Either you have them all or you have nothing. Mm-hmm. Right, you can't have just some, and so I would hope that if it does get to that point, that we just kick all the politicians off of Twitter because really.
Well, you can share your opinion with us oth@2600.com or join us on overtime at 8 o'clock where you can call us. We'll give you the number if you join us at 8 o'clock and you can call us then and actually talk to us. There are no shortages of social media platforms, including pro-Trump social media platforms. In fact, there's another one that launched just last week. This one maybe can help me pronounce this. It's spelled Getter. How do you pronounce that? Getter? No?
Getter. You know, like Gator Dunn.
Yeah, Getter's not. Yeah, but that's not a word. That's not. You know what's a word? Gutter. I'm going to say that. I'm going to call it Gutter. Yeah, Gutter, the new pro-Trump social media platform, got off to a rough start this weekend after a number. Has there ever been one of these media platforms that have not gone off to a rough start? A number of prominent GOP figures had their profiles hacked on the 4th of July. Several big-name Republicans were hit on Sunday, including the accounts for Steve Bannon, Mike Pompeo, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Jason Miller. The hacked profiles were all changed to include the message, Juba Baghdad was here, with a smiley face. Some of the accounts also included the phrase, Free Palestine. The accounts were hacked around 8:30 a.m. ET on Sunday. That's according to Insider, before being restored about 10 a.m. ET. They actually were able to reach this so-called hacker known as Juba Baghdad on Twitter. The chosen method of talking to people who have hacked other social media accounts. They said via direct message they targeted Gutter just for fun because it was easy to do. They should not publish the website before making sure everything or at least almost everything is secure. Who can argue with that? The founder of the social media network, known as Jason Miller, said, you know, you're shaking things up when they come after you. Yeah. The problem was detected and sealed in a matter of minutes, and all the intruder was able to accomplish was change a few usernames. The situation has been rectified, and we've already had more than 500,000 users sign up for our exciting new platform. Miller launched the new social media network last week as a digital safe haven for conservatives and Trump supporters. Gutter's arrival after Trump decided to recently launch and then fold his new blog. Trump's brief blogging career came after he was kicked off Twitter and Facebook earlier this year following the January 6th Capitol riot. As we know, Trump is permanently banned from Twitter, while Facebook recently said his account could be reinstated in early 2023. According to the app's site, Gutter's mission is fighting cancel culture. Oh, please. Promoting common sense, defending free speech, challenging social media monopolies, and creating a true marketplace of ideas. Any thoughts on this turn of events? Gila, go ahead.
So yesterday, I was here, obviously, since this took place over the weekend. Mm-hmm. People were talking about it again yesterday because Monday, legal holiday. And I was sitting here and I was flipping through my Twitter and I found a post from Patriot Takes, whom we appreciate. Thank you, Patriot Takes, for everything you do. Posted a statement from Jason Miller yesterday saying, "You're making it sound like there was another hack and it was really only just the one, and I don't know what everybody's so upset about." I'm sorry, if I could read the statement.
Go ahead.
I don't want to give him too much airtime, but Getter does not request personal identifying information for new users, and unlike other social media platforms, we are not interested in selling any data about our users. This is a key distinction between Getter and the social media oligarchs that base their business models on collecting and selling your information to others for lucrative sums. Additionally, Tuesday's reports make it sound as though there was a new intrusion. That is inaccurate. The brief intrusion that happened Sunday morning was quickly rectified. While the problem has already been addressed, Getter takes cybersecurity seriously and has undertaken another round of security testing by a white hat security firm to ensure safety.
Hmm.
We remain confident that our technology is sound and superior. So I'm curious if anybody heard the laughing coming from Queens when we read that statement.
I'm sure there's a lot of loud laughter in many boroughs and states throughout the nation. But yeah, you know, this seems to be a common theme where these networks are launched and it's like they didn't check so many things and all this information is just out there and is able to be accessed, and then they figure it out, or at least figure out a little bit of it. I've never checked this site. I don't know anything about it really. I imagine that if you went on there with liberal ideas, you would find yourself at the end of their cancel culture pretty quickly. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, this obviously has a lot of reminiscence of the Parler leaks, as that was in its death throes and going down. Internet archivists were extracting the data, and they did so through an API function. And my understanding with respect to the leaked data about, I think it was 90,000 or so users from Getter or Gutter, as we're saying it, I'm not sure.
I don't know. It's crazy.
It was very similar. It was some sort of negligent implementation of an API, which allowed people from the public to make calls and extract that particular data, the effect of which is analogous to a data breach. And I think that Getter or whoever's behind it should be treating this particular leak of data. It undoubtedly includes email addresses and other types of data that would be subject to regulation under the GDPR. So they should be treating this as a data breach. And I think that other regulators, perhaps from the EU or maybe even the FTC within our own government, should be looking at it with that eye as well.
What's amazing is they just launched. Well, it wasn't July 4th their launch date?
And, yes.
And 8:30 in the morning they were compromised. I mean, I think that's got to be one of the quickest compromises in history.
So what happens when you screw up an API?
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking if social networks do become common carriers and have to let anyone use them they want, like maybe this is where I need to go to start my next account to talk about how climate change is real, Black Lives Matter, trans rights are human rights, and so on. I'm sure they'll love to see me.
Red Hack, did you have something?
No, I was just going to say, I mean, in terms of the compromise speed, right? If someone poked around in the code and found the right API endpoint, that's it, right? If it was poorly designed, they just have to find, you know, where the site's code is doing the same thing. This is, and I'm sure it wasn't very well written.
Yeah.
Sounds like it anyway.
It does. All kinds of problems. Hey, I'd like to close out with something a little bit more positive. It seems that momentum is building in government to give consumers broader rights to repair products they own, everything from farm tractors to mobile phones. It's something we've been talking about on this show for many years, the right to repair. In a recent press briefing, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Joe Biden will issue an executive order directing the U.S. Department of Agriculture to issue rules that, among other things, give farmers the right to repair their own damn equipment however they like. I added a little emphasis to that, but you know that's what he meant. The order will reportedly cover more than tractors. According to a Bloomberg report, Biden will urge the Federal Trade Commission to press computer and electronics manufacturers and defense contractors to offer additional leeway in how their devices are repaired. Sounds like we're winning. Sounds like we're actually getting through to the right people and things are changing. Am I too optimistic, Kyle?
Definitely. This is the direction, I think, in all industries this topic needs to be headed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, guys. Any thoughts?
We're only 20 years into the smartphone era or so. So like, it's about time this happened.
Mm-hmm. Red Hat, go ahead.
Well, I wonder. You know, you mentioned right to repair, and immediately I thought of Tiffany, right, who's been on the show a number of times.
Yes,
talking about car repairs. My only concern is that, and you know, you asked me what I'm working on earlier. I've gotten into the car space as part of my profession.
Oh, good.
And so. You know, cars these days are tremendously complicated, and it's not as I know that when we were talking about it 15 years ago, you know, we were talking about, you know, okay, well, getting access to the computer inside the car and being able to reset things and that. And I just think that in some industries like that, it's gotten even more complex. And I would actually be concerned about safety and things like that if somebody started tinkering. Should they have the right to do that? Probably, but. But these things have not gotten simpler.
But the real issue is basically having a monopoly on being able to even access the car in the first place, so that you're forced to bring your car to the dealer for every little thing. And it's made unnecessarily complex so that only they have the right codes to access something. I know, Kyle, you can talk about this.
Yeah, I think the tinkering just ends up being a byproduct of not having suitable access in the first place. And that's where, yeah, there could be damage. And really, it's at your risk, right? If you mess with something that often voids warranty type stuff, et cetera, et cetera. I also would want to know more about vehicles in up until now, right? Okay, so it didn't all happen at once, and there are plenty of examples of cars that are somewhat simpler that there's just really no legitimate access. We've had stories personally, and I know a lot of people have tried to do things themselves, and some of that has evolved over time, but it's specific and what type of vehicle and what kind of systems you're talking about. And, yeah, for, like, braking systems and stuff like that, you definitely want someone who is using the right kind of diagnostic tools and calibration stuff. And if that's not available to, like, a third-party shop, you're eliminating the ability of mechanics to compete with the dealer. And that's that monopoly, I think that E was talking about.
Yeah, and it extends to other things, too, not just cars. Computers, phones, things like that. Things where your safety isn't quite as paramount, but it's certainly open for abuse by the people who control the technology, and you have to go through them, and you have to spend a certain amount of money, and you wind up not knowing a lot about how it actually works. Red Hack, I'm going to give you the last word, because we got to get out of here.
All right, yeah, I was going to put it another way. I think that, I agree with the idea of being able to repair your own devices. I think we're going to get to the point, though, with certain types of devices where there becomes this trade-off, because you've got, for example, a modern car, or modern cars are going to have networks in them, and those networks are going to have things that speak to each other and identify each other and use cryptography and all of that stuff. And so you start to run into this world where, yes, maybe you want to be able to repair it, but then you have to break the security mechanisms that are in place that are, you know, intended to protect it from bad actors, things like that. So again, I think that certainly since I've been on the air, things have gotten far more complex in that space. And so, yeah, that's my
word. We can continue this conversation on Overtime in just a couple of minutes, 8 o'clock on our YouTube channel 2600. Go to 2600.com and click on the link on the main page and join us at 8 o'clock. You can call us and talk to us directly. We're going to close with something fairly new from Negative Land. They're putting out albums again. Good night.
You know, Yesterday hates today. In the world we live in the modern world we live in, yesterday hates today. Today hates yesterday and tomorrow. Tomorrow hates yesterday. And as long as the days keep coming, there will be more and more tomorrows to be hated. There will be more and more tomorrow and more tomorrow, more and more tomorrows to be hated. Most importantly, though, you can always count on the fact that there is no greater hate than today has for today. If you find this hard to believe, then believe what you can for now, and put away the rest for safekeeping, because you never know what you might begin to believe later. You never know what you might begin to believe later.
Greetings, WBAI staff and listeners. If you work at WBAI or if you are a regular listener, you know that the current 2021 Pacifica Bylaws referendum vote closes Wednesday, July 7th at midnight. I'm Linda Perry, Program Director at WBAI Radio and WBAI.org, urging you to vote in this very important referendum, which is to replace the Pacifica Foundation's bylaws with new bylaws proposed by a group of Pacifica members. If adopted, significant modifications would be made to the Foundation's governance structure, affecting both the national and local station boards, including how you, as a WBAI staff member and you as a listener, are represented and can participate. While many have received ballots and have voted, many have not. If you are qualified to vote and have not yet received your e-ballot in your regular email, you may find your ballot arrived in your spam. Go there and search 2021 Pacifica Bylaws Amendment Vote. If you find it, open the link, scroll to the very bottom of the message where you can vote and obtain your receipt. Please do this before Wednesday, July 7th at 11:59 p.m. This way, your vote will count. Thanks very much.
The nomination phase of WBAI's 2021 Local Station Board elections is underway. And if you are a WBAI member, you can nominate candidates or become a candidate yourself. Go online at elections.pacifica.org to register either as a candidate or to nominate candidates. As a nominator, once approved, you will be able to log in and check the boxes next to the candidates you'd like to see on your local station board. Each potential candidate will need at least 15 nominations in order to be on the ballot this October. Members without internet access can leave a voicemail with their name, address, phone number, and the names of any candidates you'd like to nominate at 510-993-0320. For more information, visit elections.pacifica.org.